Robin DiAngelo may not be a household name, but she has coined a term that's become part of our national discourse on race: white fragility. It's the title of her book and something she's been trying to understand based on many years working as a diversity trainer, one of those people who comes to offices and leads workshops about sensitivity, implicit bias, all that kind of stuff. As Robin went from one workplace to the next trying to set the stage for healthy interactions around race, something kept happening that intrigued her. Since the book came out about a year and a half ago, the term white fragility has become familiar, even if the story behind it has not. Robin's headed to town for a talk at UMKC, and she's joining us now to tell us that story. I'm Gina Kaufman. Robin DiAngelo, welcome to KCUR's Central Standard.
Well, thank you so much.
So to start with, you are white, and you are a white person talking to other white people, essentially.
Yes.
Take our listeners with you to why that is important.
Well, racism is fundamentally a white problem, right? The construct of race was created by white people, and it benefits white people. And so we have to take it up in the same way that I think women understand that ultimately, patriarchy and sexism is a male problem in the sense of men have the ultimate power to change it, given that they control the institutions. White people control the institutions in terms of race. So legal authority and institutional control, which are the mechanisms that perpetrate racism, are in white hands. And I think James Baldwin put it beautifully when he said there's really no Negro problem. There's really only a white problem.
Those diversity trainings that I mentioned, will you talk to our listeners about what you were seeing so often that you became convinced it was a really big deal worth exploring?
Sure. I mean, at first I felt a little like a deer in headlights, kind of shell-shocked at the degree of hostility that white people demonstrated when their racial worldviews were challenged. I mean, for many white people, and I'm going to imagine it's happening for some listeners right now, just generalizing about white people will cause great umbrage. We don't like being seen racially. We don't like to have people proceed as if our race has meaning because we've been raised to see it as not having any meaning, right? I understood growing up that people had race, but not really me, right? And I expect that if we were going to talking about race, we'd be talking about their race, not mine. And so when you begin to say, well, what does it mean to be white? You get some really predictable responses. And they were so predictable and so consistent and so patterned that over time, I just got clearer and clearer at seeing what was underneath them. What are the basic assumptions?
Wait, can I stop you and ask you to just describe what those behaviors were, those predictable behaviors or thought, and then we'll get to the reasons behind them.
Yeah. Oh, well, you see silence, withdrawal, refusal to engage further, anger, debate. Explaining, minimizing.
Something that you wrote about that I really like was able to sort of put myself there and picture it was, you know, you'd see people pounding fists on tables and, you know, insisting that race doesn't matter or something like that, while the rest of the room would be sitting there, you know, either looking away uncomfortably or, just very stony and like as though there wasn't an outburst happening. Can you talk about that kind of response and the range that you were seeing kind of all at once?
Yeah, I mean, this kind of delusional sense that it is white people who are being discriminated against. I mean, we certainly see that today also. I mean, this was 20 years ago, and, you know, it's only, I think, amplified, if anything, you know, this kind of, now it is white people who are being discriminated against, these ideas of, like, reverse discrimination. you know, the other people would either just, if they were uncomfortable by the outburst, they certainly wouldn't challenge it in any way, or they'd be nodding and thinking this person was great because, you know, they had the courage to, you know, speak back. You know, it's been said when you're used to 100%, 98 feels oppressive, right? I mean, this would be happening in rooms that were 100% white, where there really weren't any people of color in those workplaces, or very, very few. And still white people would be outraged, you know, that it was us that, you know, couldn't get jobs anymore.
When just looking around would definitely challenge that.
Yes. I mean, and it hasn't changed that significantly. I mean, one of the things that I do in my presentations is just like, let's look at the actual racial demographics of the halls of power. And they're overwhelmingly white. They're also overwhelmingly male. And yet white men are 31% of the population, right? And what I just said right there is not bashing men. I'm stating facts. Right. But these are facts that it benefits us not to state. And so white fragility functions as a way to push back and to refuse that to be named.
I think it's also worth noting that you were getting the reactions that you're describing before you even got to anything tricky about racial sensitivity, like gray area. People were reacting just to the definition of racism.
Right, to simply acknowledge that inequality between the races, if you will, exists, right? You know, most people understand racism as individual, conscious malintent across race, right? That a racist is someone who doesn't like people based on race, intentionally seeks to be mean to them. And I don't know that you could have come up with a more effective way to protect the system of racism than that definition, because it pretty much exempts all white people from the system we're in, right? I have perpetrated much racial harm in my life, and it has not been conscious or intentional, but it has been harm nonetheless, right?
So I want to talk to you about that, actually. I mean, so you've established that you're a white person. I will establish that I'm a white person for any listeners who don't know that. And a lot of us white people haven't been forced, really, to examine our whiteness or think about it. You know, we can oftentimes make decisions without worrying about how our race might affect things. Again, not always true, but generally true. And I'm curious about when you started to think about your own story as being racially specific, what inspired that?
Well, actually applying for a job that I wasn't qualified for, but because I'm white, I got that job, and that was as a diversity trainer. I am now a tenured professor, associate professor, but at that time I applied for this job, and I just thought, well, won't this be fun? And I'm qualified because I'm nice, and who doesn't like to talk about these issues? And I was in for quite the shock. I mean, I was like a fish being taken out of water, and it was a parallel process. So first part was that I was working side by side with people of color who were challenging the way I saw the world. And part of being white is I could be that far in life and never have had my racial worldview challenged in general, and certainly not by people of color in particular. And then I went out into the workplace with people of color and tried to have these conversations. And the resistance was astounding. So those two pieces. And then, of course, you know, I'm not outside of anything I'm talking about. So I certainly have my own socialization to reflect on. I have certainly felt defensiveness in the past, right? So I could relate to it, but I had such a deeper understanding of it. And so eventually I could actually break it down. You know, what's happening in this room right now, and how is it functioning to actually protect racial inequality?
When you do think back, though, on your own life, given this sort of evolving interpretation of yourself as a person with a race and a person who has always had a race, is there anything that you look back on and really do think about differently now in retrospect, or even with like giant cringing?
Oh gosh, yeah. First of all, basically everything, right? Like just the fact that most white people cannot tell you what it means to be white actually contributes to an environment that is very unsupportive for people of color. Because if I can't tell you what it means to be white, I cannot hold what it means not to be white. And so because that will be so threatening to my worldview, I'm going to refuse it, right? So I can remember, well, both just the shock of recognizing that one's race has profoundly shaped one's life, but also just doing probably the most cringeworthy thing I ever did was I went out to dinner, my partner at the time and I went out to dinner with another couple I hadn't met. And when we got to the restaurant, I saw that they were both black. And so then I proceeded to tell them how racist my family was. And wasn't it amazing that they thought this and they thought that and they said this? And I thought I was showing them that, of course, I wasn't racist because I recognized how racist my family's comments were.
Yeah.
But what I was really doing was subjecting this couple to racism all night long, right?
Yeah,
And like,
probably the last thing they want to talk about,
oh, of course. And
as
then, this idea that, I don't notice your race. Well, of course, I was responding to the fact that they were black and my anxiety about it and my need to establish that I wasn't racist had me behaving just in a terrible way, right? And again, the irony is that I thought I was demonstrating how not racist I was. Now, had they had called me on it, then they would have, I know they would have received white fragility. I would have been incredibly defensive. I would have insisted that that wasn't my intention. I probably would have just shut down and withdrawn and avoided them, which is what most white people do when we get called in on our unaware. My intentions were not really relevant. The impact of my behavior that night was deep racial harm.
Can you? So that brings us to the definition of white fragility as you see it, because this is what you understand as being behind all those responses to diversity training that you saw in the workplaces that you visited, but also what you see as being behind your behavior that night.
Yeah, I mean, when I coined that term, the fragility part is meant to capture how little it takes for white people to basically melt down. And again, simply generalizing about white people will cause that, much less directly naming a pattern a white person is demonstrating that's problematic, suggesting that just by virtue of being white, you benefit from a system and are quite bluntly invested in that system. All of those things will cause white people to be extremely upset. But the impact of that upset is not fragile at all. It's a very powerful means of racial control because it marshals behind it the weight of historical and current institutional power and control. And so it essentially is a kind of unaware bullying. We make it so miserable for people of color to talk to us about those patterns, that on the one hand we would never want to have, and on the other, don't allow anybody to point out to us. We make it so difficult that most of the time they don't point it out. They just endure it because it tends to get worse, not better. I often ask people of color in my sessions, how often have you tried to give a white person feedback on their inevitable but often unaware racist patterns and have that go well for you? And even white people laugh because, we know the answer. And honestly, the most common answer is never. Second is rarely. Have we ever received that information with grace and reflected and sought to change our behavior? That's white fragility. It functions to protect the status quo, which is racism and white privilege.
I've been thinking about this while reading, and there's a story I keep coming back to from my own childhood. In fourth grade, I went to spend the night at a friend's house. My friend was black. She lived across a very sort of known and understood racial divide in Kansas City. We lived on opposite sides of that divide. But we decided to do a rate call. Do you remember these? Rate calls?
Rate call. Mm-mm.
It's a terrible, terrible game. But the idea was that you would call somebody your friend had a crush on, and you would say on their behalf, like, will you accept a rate call? And you say to this person, you name a bunch of people, and you bury your friend's name kind of in the middle so that it's not clear on whose behalf you're calling. And you ask them to rate all those people from 1 to 10. It's like crush reconnaissance. She had a crush on a white boy, and they talked all the time at school. They had like flirty banter in the fourth grade version of that. She wanted me to call this guy and ask him to rate her and other girls. And she got on another phone in the house and had her hand over the mouthpiece. And I listed all these names, and all the other names were white girls' names because my school was mostly white. And he didn't just rate her last. He rated her a 0 on a 1 to 10 scale. And after that phone call was over, my friend came back in the room, and it was silent for a minute. She looked really upset, and I must have said something to the effect of, like, I have no idea why that would happen. Because I do remember her saying, I know why. And I asked her to explain why, and she couldn't speak, but she did grab a TV guide from her bedroom, and it had Oprah Winfrey on the cover, and she pointed to Oprah's picture. And I got what she was saying, but I think that the sort of fourth grade version of white fragility in the 1980s caused me, like, really, I felt very embarrassed. I remember that. I felt embarrassed. I felt heartbroken for her. I felt disappointed. I felt a lot of things. I had no language, and I denied that this could be true. And I really regret that.
You know, let me think about that, because I think just defensiveness, right? You were trying to ease her pain with no skills and actually no actual awareness that it was indeed racism that caused him to give her a 0, right? So you know,
I think unintentionally,
you invalidated and minimized that, right?
Yeah, and I think when she said it, I think I knew she was right, but it was new, and it was, I didn't want to believe it, and I didn't know how to admit that it might be true.
Yeah, I think about, I guess we could call that, like, your inability to hold that, but I think of white fragility as a little bit deeper than just defensiveness. It's defensiveness that, because it's natural to feel defensive, right? It's defensiveness you don't move through and that you use as a way to protect a closed worldview, right? Like a refusal to know or to see, to reinforce and cling to the dominant paradigm, right, that you have. That to me is classic white fragility. I'm really clear that I'm not going to be free of my conditioning in my lifetime, right? I'm just not. But as a result of this work, I mean, I do much less of that kind of thing. when I do it, I don't get defensive, and I have really good repair skills, and that has enabled me to build trust with people of color in my life. They don't expect to never experience these moments with us, but when they do surface, the question is, where can we go from here? And if they can't go there with us, right, if they can't talk to us about what just happened and how it impacted them, then we're not going to have trust or an authentic relationship. You know,
Can you talk about those repair skills? Okay. Because I think maybe that's part of what keeps people from, and specifically, I guess I should say, white people from moving past these moments of embarrassment or defensiveness or whatever, just like not knowing where to go from here. Other than that, that's what's been modeled. That's what, you know, what's the other, right? What does the other picture look like?
Well, you know, I really sincerely don't believe we can get to it from the dominant paradigm, right? And the dominant paradigm says only mean people are racist. And so when it's called out to somebody, when it's pointed out, what they feel is, I've just been told I'm a bad person, and that's unbearable. And so we have to explain it away or minimize it or deny it. To have good repair skills, you have to start from the premise that it is inevitable that you have these blind spots, if you will, and that on occasion you're going to do harm, intentional or not. And so then you actually are grateful, right? You realize that this is a really precious moment of trust and risk that this person took to talk to me about this, given most of the time it doesn't go well. And you see this as a potential opportunity for growth, your own growth, right? I want to know where my blind spots are so that I can change them, right?
You know, you write about the importance of naming things, naming racism, for example, but your context for that is largely historical and goes beyond race. Like, suffragettes had to convince people who had access to the right to vote to see their struggle and to grant them that access that they didn't already have. They weren't in the position to just quietly vote for candidates who sympathized with them because they couldn't vote. What are some of the other examples of how this kind of historically has worked, this power of naming things and having these things really recognized?
Well, and let's just name it men. Okay, so women could not be granted their civil rights, in this case, the right to vote, except for men to grant it to them. Women could be prejudiced against men, but their prejudice wasn't backed by power. That's the difference between bias, which everybody has, and in this case that we're talking about, racism, which transforms bias into a system, right? So we could look at it historically, but let's look at, again, the halls of power, which I break down in my book. But let's look at, for example, the 100 top grossing films of all time, right? I think most of us with any self-awareness recognize that we've been shaped by film, right? By media, by television, by representation. And so those who write and direct films are our cultural authors, right? Of the 100 top grossing films of all time, 99 were directed by men and 95 of them white. That's an astoundingly homogeneous worldview, but it's presented as universal and objective. So those are just filmmakers or film directors, but Spike Lee is always going to be a black filmmaker or a black director. So that's one thing that reinforces for white people that other people don't have, which is that white people represent humanity and so are both universal and objective, right? And individuals, right?
You know, when you talk about the importance of recognizing that race, that having someone point out a racist remark or a racist way of approaching a topic or approaching a conversation or something like that, that isn't just only a terrible person could possibly do that. How do you reconcile that? Because I think we generally, not 100% of everyone agrees on this, but I think most people agree that racism isn't good.
Right. I mean, racism is not good. Let me put it like this. I was socialized into a racist worldview, right? I used to use examples of filmmakers. It circulates everywhere. These very repetitive, consistent, narrow representations of people of color. And as a result, I have racial biases. The research here is really clear. I also have racist patterns and investments. I did not choose to be socialized into this system. So I don't feel guilty about it. But I do feel responsible for the outcome of that socialization, right? So racism is bad in that sense, but it's just not useful to think about people in terms of good people versus bad people. And good people are not racist and bad people are. Because as soon as we set up that binary, you know, what side is the average white person going to put themselves on? So I think we need to challenge the system of racism, but not look at it in an either or kind of construct.
But in a world where we do see that there is a deliberate form of racism that does exist and a really malicious form of racism that does exist, how it is a little bit tricky to navigate there being just this one word that encapsulates all of it.
Yeah, I know. It is tricky. So I think about, for example, white supremacy. You know, that's a charged term, and I grew up seeing that as people in white hoods. And certainly the term includes them. But it's also a highly descriptive sociological term for the society we live in, a society that elevates white people as the norm and representative of humanity, and everyone else representing a very particular kind of humanity, right? And we are in a cultural moment, cultural political moment, in which explicit racism has been given, you know, a lot of permission to circulate again. And yes, I am not an avowed racist, right? To me, an avowed racist embraces their conditioning. That would be a Richard Spencer, for example, organized the Unite the Right march in Charlottesville. I'm not an avowed racist. I seek to challenge my conditioning into a racist system. But I think of it more as a continuum, right? So Donald Trump, for example, I would say that I'm not actually less racist than he is. So everybody kind of take a minute. I swim in the same water he does. There isn't any stereotype that he has said that I'm not familiar with. He's not pulling these stereotypes out of the ether, right? They're not nonsensical. And I have absorbed the same stereotypes. The difference between us is that he embraces and uses and repeats and reinforces those stereotypes, and I seek to challenge them. But as soon as I think, oh, well, he's racist and I'm not, I'm going to become complacent. And I contribute in my own way. It's just different than the way that he contributes. And a lot of my work is for the white progressives, the NPR types. Because I actually think that we cause a lot of daily harm too. It just looks different. It's not going to be the explicit N-word. I'm never going to say the N-word. But I'm very clear that my inability, the collective inability for most white people to answer the question, what does it mean to be white, actually creates a hostile environment for people of color in primarily white spaces. We really have to change what we understand it means to say that whiteness is circulating.
In the time that your book has been out, talk to me about how people have responded both to the book itself and its contents and to just the term white fragility, because I'll be honest, before preparing for this conversation, I knew the term well. I hadn't read the book. And I think that those two things, there can be a difference in terms of what people are reacting to.
Yeah, I mean, I've certainly had people say, I don't like the term white fragility, which is kind of funny. White fragility shuts down a conversation on white fragility, right? Like, white people, we are raised to be ignorant on race and racism, right? I mean, you can get through graduate school in this country without ever discussing racism. And yet we're so arrogant in our ignorance, to be blunt, right? So how have people responded to the book? Well, it's been on the New York Times bestseller list for well over a year now, and I get incredible emails from people all over the world who say, thank you for giving me language for a dynamic that I either have perpetrated if I'm white, or that I, you know, have experienced and been on the receiving end if I'm a person of color. I would say overall, it's actually been incredibly useful because it's given language to something that's familiar to white people as well as people of color. And I'm hoping makes it harder for us to run these patterns of white fragility, to run this devastating nonsense without any accountability, because up until now we have run it without any accountability. So now I'm hoping it's more difficult to do that because we can name it and speak to it and break it down and look at it. Of course, I get death threats, right? On the one side of the spectrum, I also understandably have people of color. Some feel resentful, right? I mean, people of color have been saying this for hundreds of years, right? And one of the kind of ironies of this is that when a white person says it, white people are more open to hearing it, which of course reinforces the centrality of the white voice. And yet to not use this voice and this platform to break with white solidarity for me is unacceptable. So there's a tension there that I've learned to live with.
Robin DeAngelo, thanks so much.
You're so welcome.
Robin is the author of White Fragility, Why It's So Hard for White People to Talk About Racism. There's a talk with Robin DeAngelo at UMKC on October 30th. That's this Wednesday. You can get the details online. It's listed on Eventbrite and elsewhere. Up next, uncertainty. And I don't mean I don't know what's coming up. I mean, we're talking about new research about uncertainty. This is KCUR's Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman. Stay tuned. I'm Gina Kaufman, and now we're talking about uncertainty. We may think we know what's going to happen in the future, but we don't. Not for sure. And yet we proceed with confidence. How do we do it? What kinds of mental gymnastics are we doing to pull it off? That's what Tim Pluscotch wanted to know. He's a professor of psychology at KU and one of three co-authors of a book called Taming Uncertainty. Hi, Tim.
Hi, Gina.
This book was written in a way that reflects something we actually do know about navigating uncertainty, and that is trusting the wisdom of the group over the whims of the individual. Can you explain that?
Yeah. So in the book, we take this kind of approach to understand how people have navigated uncertainty throughout our being. And the idea is that there's a lot of successful tools that we have at our disposal.
That we aren't even aware we're using.
That we're not aware of using, or in some cases we are. And so we identified several of these, and one of them is to look towards others to kind of infer different estimates or handle the uncertainty we're facing. We think of it as like we think of the mind as kind of like a mechanic, right? And and you have a lot of different tools. And just like a mechanic has tools, but also has friends or colleagues they can turn to, you have friends or colleagues you can turn to handle uncertainty. A good example is the wisdom of the crowd, right? So there's a famous example of when you're trying to, I mean, the example is at a county fair and you're asked to estimate how much a cow weighs. If you ask one person at the county fair, they won't be very good. But if you get if you take the average of all these estimates across a large number of people, it tends to be quite good of an estimate.
But, you know, I want to say something. We trust the group, but as soon as you call that a mob, we don't trust that at all.
Sure. And so that's the question of asking, under what situations should you trust the group? And is the mind, and are you pretty good at identifying those cases? And that's one of the things we try to take up in the book is like, hey, under what situations should you trust the mob or
so
trust the group?
Explain how you and your co-authors wrote the book together in a way that reflects this understanding of that, like, the group works better than the individual.
Yeah, so this is a good example. Our book is actually a demonstration of this. There's three lead authors, myself, Ralph Hertwig, Torsten Parkour. But what we did was we were running this group in Berlin where we had about 30 different researchers, all from different perspectives, biology, philosophy, statistics, economics, psychology. And we were all working on this topic about how people handle uncertainty. And so what we did was we wrote the book, essentially harnessing the wisdom of the crowd, where we all took leads on a particular set of chapters, and then we passed it around, and we got feedback as we wrote the book. And so essentially, there's really 30 authors of all of the entire book. And so that was our way of kind of using our own medicine and saying, look, there's some wisdom of the crowd. And that was exciting and interesting, right? Because all of a sudden, I'd get a new perspective from an engineer who said, I don't know what you're writing here. This is a bunch of garble, but here's how I would use it. And so we were able to kind of get this diversity of opinion and kind of learn about how we think the mind actually handles uncertainty.
This sounds great in theory, but if I'm like trying to decide what to do at an intersection, I don't have time to ask 30 people.
Yeah, and so that's part of our point is that you have, just like a mechanic has different tools available, sometimes you could consult your friends, but some cases you might fall back on like a heuristic, right?
And those
are rules. Heuristics are like a rule of thumb that you can use. And it's not always going to give you the right answer, but often it does. And so in our field, we've been studying what kind of heuristics do people use. An example is like thinking about you could fall back on a default, right? What is the choice you used last time? Or one of the heuristics we talk about in the book is a risk-reward heuristic. So when I have to estimate the likelihood of an event, a good cue is the size of the payoff, right? So how big of a payoff is that? And in our world, right, it tends to be that big payoffs are kind of unlikely. And so that's a good heuristic for people to use. And we ask, okay, what does that have? What's the consequences about how that impacts behavior if people are using that strategy? And where would that be an effective strategy to use?
So are these conscious shortcuts or are they subconscious? Because I when you say this, I think about all of the like almost always rhyming phrases people use to sort of guide the little mantras. But I think on some level, you're also talking about the things that we don't even realize we're calculating.
Yeah, that's a really good question. It's a question that a lot of psychologists have been grappling with. And I'm not going to answer that for you because there can be different conscious or unconscious processes. Often we're going to talk about these in a much more conscious process, like, okay, what kind of rule do I use? But eventually, over practice, that might become a more automatic process that's more subconscious. And so that's a way to think about it. And you're right. We're surrounded, right, by all sorts of rules that are given to us, right? And that can come from being told, okay, that's a good heuristic or a good rule. Or we can kind of learn.
A stitch in time saves nine.
Yeah, stitch in time saves nine. A bird in the hand is better than a two in a bush, right? These are all different heuristics we learn. And what we want to know is under what cases do those heuristics work? And I wonder under what cases and what situations do they not work?
Oh.
Sometimes if you use them, you might make some mistakes.
Yeah, give me an example of a time when it doesn't work.
Oh.
Plunge me right into this crisis of my own good decision-making.
Yeah, so certain cases, so let's go back to the risk-reward heuristic, right? A place where that's not going to be a very good heuristic to use is, for example, in a brand new market. Right, when it's brand new and everyone's just sorting out what prices are associated with different events, that would not be a very effective heuristic to use in terms of estimating the likelihood of an event occurring. But as a market forms and you get more experience and there's more buyers and sellers, you know, that relationship between the price and say like a lottery ticket or anything like that is going to kind of emerge, and you'd be able to use that heuristic.
So it's matching the tool to the job if we're going to stick with our mechanic analogy.
Exactly. And so that's a challenge we have as people trying to navigate uncertainty, right? And that actually adds a whole nother level of uncertainty, right? You have to think about, okay, what strategy do I want to use at this given time?
Can you define uncertainty as you're using that term real quick before we continue taming it?
Yeah. So, I mean, in a very general sense, right? Anytime you lack a definite knowledge of what the event is going to create, right? But in fact, what we talk about in the book is that
so you're trying to make a decision within some context where you don't know what's going to happen, which would
you
be
don't know,
technically all the time.
But what we talk about, right, is that actually there's all sorts of different types of uncertainty that we face, and that actually I think helps us kind of understand the concept a bit. So for example, you might face strategic uncertainty. Right, strategic uncertainty is where you don't know, you're interacting with another person and you don't know how they're going to act. Another type of uncertainty is temporal uncertainty, we don't know when the event is going to happen. Our dedication of the book is a playoff of Benjamin Franklin's famous saying, right? Nothing certain in life except death and taxes. And our dedication says, to all things uncertain, including death and taxes. And so death is kind of there's at least temporal uncertainty when that event is going to happen for us.
You know, I have to say, my heart rate is going up just thinking about uncertainty. And if our listeners have a tried and trusted strategy for dealing with it, feel free to run it by our expert. He's one of the co-authors of a new book, Taming Uncertainty, and we'll be right back. 816-235-2888 is the number to call. 816-235-2888. Central Standard's coming right back. I'm Gina Kaufman, joined by a KU professor of psychology, Tim Pluscotch. He's talking about a book he co-wrote with some of his colleagues. It's called Taming Uncertainty, and specifically the mental shortcuts we take that allow us to make decisions in the absence of complete information and absolute certainty. Tim Pluscotch, hello again.
Hello.
So the word for these shortcuts is heuristics, as you've said. Why do we need shortcuts? I think a lot of us imagine that a long thought out decision making process is the smartest, to take your time and think it through.
Oh, that's an excellent question. Well, I would argue, yeah, that seems good in theory, right? But in practice, we face time pressure. Even our own mental capacities are limited, right? And so we can't be like the all knowing rational being, right, to handle uncertainty. And so if you follow that argument through, that means we actually have to use some shortcuts to do this. So a very good example of a heuristic that we probably all might have learned at some point is called the fly ball heuristic, right? So if I ask you, if I ask you to describe how to catch a fly ball, right, you could ask a physicist and they might tell you, well, okay, you should kind of calculate the trajectory of the ball and you can intersect it if you can figure out the velocity and the acceleration and do some calculus to figure that out. However, there's a simple solution that will guarantee that you'll at least run into the ball. So when the ball is hit by a baseball player, if you keep your eye on the ball and you keep the angle at the same level, so you run to keep it at the same angle, you're going to run smack into that ball. And so that would be a simple strategy that you can use that's quite effective under many cases. And it doesn't require you to do the advanced math that you'd have to do, right? And so that'd be a demonstration of where these rules can be quite effective. And we don't actually have to rely on something that's maybe even impossible for our mind to carry out at that level of time that we need to do it.
I am being very serious when I say that your descriptions of uncertainty are, I can feel my heart rate going up. And I want to ask you about that because your expertise is psychology. And when I think about the range of people I know, I also think about a difference in terms of how comfortable people are with uncertainty and how much anxiety it is likely to provoke. And I wonder what you can tell me about that. I mean, you talked about risk reward. I know some people in sales, some people who do like quick decision making all the time in their work and a lot of money is on the line. And they seem to kind of be energized by the gamble of that. Whereas I work surrounded by journalists and most of us like to gather tons of information.
Oh, that's a... So we all handle uncertainty in different ways, right? And so, in fact, if you talk to the entrepreneur, right, from your perspective, right, you're like, wow, they're just in this sea of uncertainty. They're just going at it.
And yet speaking so boldly.
Yeah, but from their perspective, when they've gone back and look at them, they don't actually see it as uncertainty, right? They see it as like kind of what we call risk, right? I know, okay, there's some likelihoods of these different events and I'm going to act on those, right? So it's a little bit about your frame of reference about how you look at it. Interesting enough, also, that changes across your lifespan. And that's something we talk about in the book too, right? So, sometimes you're a risk taker, right, when you're younger, and that transitions and changes over time. And what we talk about is that we actually don't have a very good sense about why that's happening and how that's happening. But we do know that as you age, you become a different type of risk taker and how you handle uncertainty. And I think that's one part. And there's also an interesting thing I'll just bring up is that the type of uncertainty you face changes too, right? As you age, your different mental capacities change as well. And that introduces its own uncertainty.
You have actually this intense focus for a portion of the book on adolescent behavior. What's interesting about adolescent behavior as far as this lifespan, this life trajectory of dealing with uncertainty? What's unique about being an adolescent?
Well, we're all probably familiar with the adolescent being a little bit of a time period of risk-taking, right? But it's actually kind of an interesting place to see if it's an adaptive aspect of how you're behaving. And can we understand how they're, like, if, as you change and in adolescence, how you handle those risks? And if that gives us a sense of what type of uncertainty they're facing and how that actually might get them ahead. Even in terms of understanding the risks, so they might not be taking the same risks or perceive them as the same risks as us.
You know, your book is called Taming Uncertainty, which implies that it's this force that in some way threatens us or that we wouldn't want to hang on to and allow to thrive. Is that always the case?
I don't think so. In fact, my PhD student, we had an ongoing discussion whether or not we should call the book Taming Uncertainty. He was telling me we should call it Embracing Uncertainty, right? Because we talk about it as this human condition that's just, as we've talked about in this interview, that we're always in this face of uncertainty. And in many ways, we've learned to kind of live with it, right? And so it's not so much always a dangerous thing. And I think we've actually become quite effective in handling many aspects of our uncertain worlds, right? But I think at some level, there's a place where we're taking on this uncertainty and we're quite effective. And that's something we're trying to understand in the book.
Has this research made you stressed out? Because being super aware of all the little kinds of decisions we make without really knowing what's going to happen all the time would make me personally crazier than now.
It's probably stressed my wife out because if you ask her, I'm always thinking about like what are the alternatives and what are different ways we could do that, and that drives her nuts. But I think it's also been kind of invigorating for me, right? It's a way for me to think, hey, you know, can we help people make better decisions, and how can we do that if we start to understand how people operate? And so, in some ways, it's been very invigorating. So, like the questions we ask is like, "Hey, what kind of, if you're using these rules, can we help you have better rules to use in making these decisions?"
What's an example of a rule that you found we might do well to replace with a different one?
Oh, so we have a chapter in the book on dietary decision making. And this is research led by a postdoc in our group, Mattia Dallacher and Ralph Hertwig, where they were asking, okay, dietary decision making, you know, we face this big crisis of obesity in our culture. What are some places that we could help people make better decisions? And so there's actually, so one place is they started a study, what rules could you do on particular situations? They looked at like the family dinner. Right, so what are some places in the family meal that we could implement some simple rules that people could maybe improve their mealtime? And so they did a big meta-analysis, and they showed, you know, if you look at the results, improving the duration of the meal has a big effect. Telling people to turn off the TV or having people turn off the TV, these are simple rules that help improve the mealtime and the health of the how healthy people are eating at the meal.
So people actually make better decisions about food when the TV is off?
Yeah.
That's interesting.
And that's correct. And that's, so we think of that as like a building block for a particular rule that you can start to see that, okay, what are some simple things that we could use?
You also have a bit of a focus on pedestrian navigation?
Yeah, so this is a research scientist in our group, Mehdi Mousaid. He's very interested in how people navigate the crowd, right? So how do you move in a crowd of people? And so this is a question that's been studied in physics, and they often describe people as kind of particles and atoms moving in the space, and he's interested: what heuristics and what rules do people actually use in this situation? So one thing he talks about is following another person to where you want to get. Right? How effective is that? Under what situations would that fail?
So, as in, we're walking together, and I'm just going to keep going where you're going.
Yeah, or you're getting off a train and a subway, and you don't know where you have to get out, but you can pick a person. right, and follow them? And under what situations is that a rule that would be a very effective strategy? And what are the consequences of using that rule? Obviously, it will fail in certain places.
Tim Pluscotch, I've been having to navigate the uncertainty of when you were going to stop talking, but I'm watching the clock and I think I need to say goodbye now.
Okay, thank you.
Tim Pluscotch is a KU professor of psychology, and he's been with us from KPR in Lawrence. He's one of the co-authors of Taming Uncertainty. Shout out to KPR for their help. That's a wrap for this morning's show. You can grab anything you might have missed at kcur.org/centralstandard. That'll be ready for you by the end of the day. Tomorrow, a Kansas City Star editorial writer has written that bike lanes are not what people living in distressed areas really want or need. Kansas City's bicycling enthusiasts have gone to great lengths to win him over. How'd that all turn out? Tomorrow, find out. KCUR Central Standard is produced by Melody Rao with Mackenzie Martin and Noah Taborda. Sylvia Maria Gross is our senior producer. I'm Gina Kaufman. Up to date's next.